I mentioned this particular episode of Anshir Zahiri simply to exemplify the fact that the Prime Minister, even under such publicly embarrassing circumstances, was by himself incapable of dismissing outright a minister without the intervention of the Shah.
What about other ministers? Some of them were his friends. You mentioned, for instance, Majid Rahnuma.
Majid Rahnuma was, I think, a kind of special case. Majid Rahnuma...
They had been at university together in Beirut.
They were old friends from Beirut, then I think in Paris. I think that they were also in the foreign ministry together. They were colleagues in that sense. And Majid's intellectual left of center credentials were really quite impeccable. All right, he'd been associated with Princess Ashraf, and he'd been ambassador to Switzerland. But he'd always retained, if you like, contact with the more liberal constituencies, if you like. I think, whatever one may think of Majid, and I am admiring of him, but if there is this thread that runs through his character, a kind of even a somewhat unwise espousal of everything which was to the left of center of its day. Eminently qualified he would have been for any ministerial job in Iran. He was offered during Haveda's premiership the post of Minister of Science and Higher Education. And I think this was done really over and above the opposition of Savak, who considered his political leanings in his student days as somewhat suspect, to put it mildly. But it was predictable and regrettable that very early on there was a falling out between Majid and the Savak authorities over the handling of some student disturbances at Tehran University. And of course, it was inconceivable that in a situation like that, the head of Savak could go. So Majid went. But I do remember, for instance, once when he was in charge of the ministry, that he insisted that the Prime Minister seize personally some of the leaders of the disturbances. So-called, they might have been legitimate grievances. I wasn't privy to the nature of the student demand at the time. It's predictable that they were saying, let's have more laboratories and less tanks, and that it would have been that kind of a situation. And Majid brought these people to the three of them, I remember, and it was late at night, 9-ish, 9:30-ish, to see Haveda. The students waited in the waiting room while Majid went in and, as they say in Persian, cooked the Prime Minister, prepared the Prime Minister to receive these student leaders, and also to tell him what the students would say and what he's expected to say. Anyway, eventually the students went in. I don't know what transpired, but they stayed there for about an hour. There must have been a healthy airing of their views. It could only have been salutary. And when the students came out, and I went in to see, I was summoned to go and see Haveda, There were smiles all around, so something, however minimal, had been accomplished. But I, who knew Majid well, and could allow myself to pull his leg, said, I remember, to Hoveyda's uncontrollable laughter, that whatever the legitimate grievances of Majid's student friends were, they did smell somewhat. Whereupon he, and Majid said that their smell was infinitely healthier than any artificial scent that I had put upon myself.
Oh, really?
But all this said in a very kind of jokey way.
Yes, yes. And what about other personalities? It's very important because, I mean, obviously being in that office, you saw everybody who came and went. So, I mean, talk about all the other personalities who, or anecdotes that would illustrate their relationship with the power and their methods of work, and the method of work of Hoveyda particularly. I mean, any salient feature in any important personality who was in charge of something or other, because after all, even if the Shah dictated everything, there was a machinery that was handled by these people, and whenever personality is involved, it has some kind of an influence on the machine. I mean, nowadays they say that even a scientist observing through a microscope, his personality has some effect on what he observes. So that one could, I mean, were there any people there who struck you as being more or less powerful, important? I mean, anything that you can remember of that power?
Yes, there are a number of quite dominant figures in Hoveyda's cabinet. And they've been around for a very long time. Al-Muzaffar, I think, is certainly one. Al-Muzaffar, who succeeded him when... Al-Muzaffar was immensely intelligent. He was more experienced in terms of ministerial responsibility than Hoveyda when Hoveyda assumed office.
Hajib Al-Muzaffar, he was more experienced.
He was more experienced. Am I on?
Yes.
There was a kind of mutual respect that that Amir Abbas and Jamshid demonstrated towards one another. And I never, as long as Hoveyda was Prime Minister, ever detect even a slight hint of friction. Certainly no display of public anger, no backbiting, not even mild arguments. When you think that he, Al-Muzaffar, was someone who served under Hoveyda for 12 years, this is really quite remarkable. He presided, Amir Abbas, over the cabinet as a kind of primus inter pares, as a first amongst equals. But everyone was aware that if matters couldn't be hammered out to a solution at the cabinet level, then there was the necessary journey up the hill to see the Shah. And unless you commanded enough attention with the Shah to be able to go and air your own case privately, if somebody else did it for you, you didn't necessarily always come out the best. So there was a slight reluctance to have disagreements of the cabinet reported up to the Shah. There was every effort to try to hammer things out during the cabinet, and of course I think this was Hoveyda's main function. He was, if you like, he acted, if you like, as the Shah's principal private secretary in that regard. I don't say this in any kind of derisory way. I don't want to diminish his role, his contributions, but I think any prime minister of the Shah's was really a conciliator, if you like, of the differing points of view that were finding themselves in this one channel which led to the Shah. And I think in that regard, he functioned terribly well.
And were you present at cabinet meetings?
I wasn't present at cabinet meetings, no. The cabinet had a secretary who was a minister.
And where did it take place?
At the office of the Prime Minister.
And then there were also weekly sessions, cabinet sessions with the Shah, or didn't attend?
There were weekly, what they called high economic council meetings in the presence of the Shah. And these, in a sense, were even more important, if you like. They were held every Monday afternoon, I remember, because that allowed me to get an occasional game of tennis in. These meetings really decided on the economic guidelines of the country for the future, really. And people present there at those meetings really had far greater clout than the ministers who, for some reason or other, were not included. For instance, the Minister of Education would not have participated, the Minister of Health would not have participated. But the Minister of Economy, the Minister of Finance, the Armed Forces people again, were always present.
What about the plan organization? What was the role of the plan organization in the whole thing?
The plan organization was also very much represented at the High Economic Council meetings. They, after all, were the people who handled the oil money. And Maggie Dee, for instance, for a very long time in charge of the plan organization, was a central figure. And I think it's a tribute, really, to Maggie Dee, to his charm and to his good temper, that he stayed at that post for a very long time and incurred neither the wrath of the Prime Minister nor of the other ministers, nor indeed of the Shah, even though he was, I think, at the end, unjustly dismissed when, in 1977, things started going economically wrong. There was a desperate search for a scapegoat, and Maggie Dee, as the head of the plan organization, was dismissed, even though the decisions that he had carried out were those that had been jointly agreed at the High Economic Council, or had been transmitted to him directly by His Majesty.
Yes. Any other personalities? What about Ansari, whom everybody, at least everybody I have interviewed, has said that he was a rather, well, what shall I say, not a very, not a character that everybody said good things about. They didn't know how he had accumulated his money, they didn't know how.
Well, I don't know. He accumulated his money, but he did come, when he did become the Minister of Economy, he came to that post already a rich man. I think he'd been very successful in private enterprise before coming to the Ministry of Economy, and he was very much in the mold of an American executive. He was a kind of whiz kid, if you like. He was a facts and figures man. He had a very quick and sharp mind. He was imaginative and he was bold. I think he was also rather liked by the Shah, but what he would consider his accomplishments his achievements as Minister of Economy. I don't know. Although to his credit, I must say, I think all those plans for buying up chunks of going Western concerns, such as Mercedes-Benz or Babcock and Wilcox, or participation in German industry. I think there were a number of other ventures that Iran participated in. I think he ought to take the credit for such bold initiatives in the field of business.
Well, anybody else you would like to talk about? Any salient anecdote, anything that could have been somewhat influential on the course of events?
Not really that I can think of, not at that level of thing, no.
Were you aware, for instance, or was Hoveda aware of dissidents in the country?
Oh, absolutely. Sabak, which had a huge organization, was constantly circulating documents mentioning the kind of dissident activity that there was in Iran, what the sources of finance for these organizations were, the areas in which they were most active, and there was, of course, also the organization which, in a sense, oversaw the functions of Savak, the private bureau, which, if you remember, during the revolution, became a very murky organization, and its head, a man called Pardus, was accused of having collaborated with the clerics in bringing about the revolution. There were always people from these organizations who were seeing Hoveda, and of course they had direct access to the Shah, so it is for me virtually inconceivable that one did not know what was going on.
So what was your reaction, or everybody's reaction, that, you know, that if one were not more careful, maybe something would blow over?
Oh, I think what is totally important to bear in mind, particularly in the context of the 1979 revolution, is that the Shah did bring in land reform. He did bring in equal rights for women, or at least voting rights for women. He did bring in the status of forces agreement, which actually gave the Americans immunity from Iranian jurisdiction. And he did, when the riots broke out in 63, expel Khomeini from Iran, and there was no revolution. He survived in 1963 this tremendous upheaval, which he himself had initiated at the behest of Kennedy, and had withstood the organized opposition of the more fanatical clergy, i.e. Khomeini. In fact, not only was there not a revolution in Iran, but the decade following 1963 to 1973 witnessed some of the most remarkable changes, which the Shah must be given credit for, in transforming the Iranian economy from an agrarian backward society to what it was hoping to become. A semi-industrialized society in which the income from oil was building an infrastructure on which viable industry could operate. So it's not the activities of the dissidents from 1963 to even up to 1978 that led to the revolution. One must look for that to other causes. If we are now talking about the roots of the Iranian revolution, I think And I'm not sure that we are talking about that. Are we talking about that?
We were talking about personalities and so on. But you see, everything will throw a light over what happened afterwards. At the time, obviously, there were people who were far-seeing and who foresaw, maybe.
I think to get back to the question that you haven't asked, really, if we examine the events from 1973 on, we come across the fundamental flaws in the policy that the Shah was pursuing. One faults them with hindsight, but certainly in 73, when the oil price rose dramatically, you can't question the Shah's intentions for the welfare of his people. He went about it in the wrong way, I can now say with hindsight. There was this idea that you could throw money at every problem, that it could solve it. And this led to a tremendous dislocation in the Iranian economy, with backlogs of all sorts, and a shortage of trained manpower. I mean, I think at the end, towards the end in 1977, there was something like 6,000 Filipino drivers alone in Iran who were driving up trucks from the Persian Gulf up to the northern, more populated urban centers, because there weren't even enough Iranians who knew the craft of driving, for instance. I mean, it became really that bad. That, in addition to the fact that the armed forces had been given such priority over domestic needs. This was known all along, but it was experienced in the summer of 77, when power failures started, for instance. The Shah, and indeed his government, had been at pains to point out, whether they actually believed it or not is immaterial, that the expenditure on the armed forces, necessary as it was for the defense of the country and the integrity of Iran, were not at the expense of the domestic sector. But when you had, in the summer of 77, the spectacle of one of the greatest oil-producing and exporting countries of the world suffering power failures because the electricity grid had broken down, or because there wasn't sufficient hydroelectric power to go around, then there was a tremendous loss of credibility, if you like. This is what Najibi basically got fired for. This hunt for scapegoats then began.
But let's go back to your to Hoveyda's relationship, for instance, with the court, not only with the Shah personally, but also with other members of the court. For instance, Princess Aisha, who apparently was very influential by all accounts, the Queen. All the other people around, the Minister of Court, were, for instance, Hassan Alam, when he was.
Asadullah Alam,
and so forth. What was his relationship with all that? Did he go to.
His relationship with the Queen, I think, was immensely cordial. I think that because they had shared a background of French education, because they had both experienced semi-poverty in their younger days. They shared an outlook on life which the Shah, with his more militaristic vision of life, couldn't really envisage. I remember that there was a kind of unspoken understanding between Empress Para and Hoveyda, who held great respect for one another's knowledge of French culture and books and literature. I mean, it was a field which on which the Shah never could trample, if you like. He might be much more knowledgeable about F4s or F16s, but there was this kind of unannounced respect and admiration, which I think was mutual between Hoveyda and the Empress.
And did he go to the court and so on outside work? In other words, did he participate in the...
Yes, he did. He was he was always present, even at court functions, even though I think on many occasions he would turn up simply put in an act of presence and not even stay for dinner, disappear. Because, of course, the demands on his time were such that he would have to be up and functioning early in the morning, and he didn't want to sit down and watch movies after dinner. There was this cordiality with the Empress. His relationship with Princess Ashraf were more strained. Princess Ashraf was, as you say, an immensely powerful figure and really quite implacable in her opposition to people who stood in her way. She could be immensely loyal and supportive to her friends. I think was the most generous
patrons.
Of patrons. That's certainly true in my case. She was rather unsharing of her brother with other people. If there is such a term, her affection for her brother was exclusivistic. This is a trait in her character which she demonstrated towards all who came close to the Shah. Maybe it is a trait in twins, I don't know. After all, she was the twin, and she... I know, for instance, that her relationship with Soraya, the Shah's previous wife, were known to be on very bad terms with one another. But with Farah, it was, if there was any underlying differences, they were always patched up in public. There was outward cordiality. And I'm not really sure that Princess Ashraf saw on a sort of frequent basis or cared to see others of her family. I know she very rarely saw her elder sister, for instance, very rarely. Very rarely saw her mother, who was much closer to the elder sister than she was to her. Yes.
Shall we go now to your own relationship with the princess? Because after you left the Prime Minister's office, you went to work for Princess Ashraf. Could you tell us how it happened and what was your own relationship?
Yes, I didn't quite leave the Prime Minister's office in that sense. The princess had a number of international obligations.
How did you meet?
Well, we'd met socially previously, but There were parties at courts and a few new mutual friends. They would clear your name first and then you'd be out. But I'd met with Sashov two or three times. Curiously enough, the name of Princess Ashraf came up in a more serious context was when Hoveyda mentioned it, that he'd been to see her, and she was then going off to India to attend, I think it was the centenary of Gandhi's birth. And she, the princess, had told Hoveyda that her international responsibilities were expanding and that she was very much in need of someone who could come and take over her secretariat and the expanding volume of work, and could Hoveyda find someone for her. And I think Hoveyda had said that he would bear this in mind. The princess had insisted, and it was decided that I should be lent to the princess on loan for a visit, for an impending visit to India. And so, if you like, the first time that I saw the princess in a working capacity was this trip to India, which didn't actually go down terribly well.
Why not? In what way?
It didn't go down.